This is the Kinky Cast. This is an adult, sexually explicit podcast. If you are under 18 years old, please stop the podcast now. This is episode 33 of our weekly exploration in the kinky world of BDSM and alternative relationships. Today our guests are Ernest Green and Nina Hartley. Here's our hosts, Woody and the Beast.
Thanks, Max, and welcome back to another edition of the Kinky Cast. Sitting across the table are two lovely people. Hey, Beast, how are you tonight?
I would count one lovely people, and then there's me. I'm good, Woody. I'm good. Speaking of lovelies, we have Kate Kinsey in the studio with us today.
Oh, y'all are so complimentary. I know you just want to see me naked, but okay.
And you have your clothes on. Last time we had in the studio, you were topless.
Well, it's a little cooler in here today.
Oh.
If you're good, maybe I'll strip later.
Please.
Let's get to what I've been looking forward to for a while now.
We all have.
We have got some fabulous guests for you tonight. The ultimate porn power couple, the Brad and Angelina of BDSM adult entertainment. Ernest Green, who is the, if you've been under a rock and you don't know, is a groundbreaking BDSM and fetish filmmaker. He's also the editor of Hustler's Taboo magazine and the author of a new erotic novel called Master of O, which is a modern retelling of the classic story of O. And as if that's not enough, we've got an embarrassment of riches. He has with him tonight his wife, slave, and as he describes her, his muse, Nina Hartley.
Hello.
Yeah, she is basically the very definition of a legendary porn star. But she's so much more than that. She's also a film director, a sex educator, a feminist, and an author. So welcome to Kinky Cast.
Well, thank you for having us. Excited to be here.
Well, good. I basically want to, you know, talk about a little bit about how you both got started. Ernest, you started out as a journalist and radio host?
Yes, I did. I had a couple of careers before I found my way into this one. I was a mainstream-type journalist. I wrote for magazines and newspapers, some of them with names we know. And then had a turn as a mainstream screenwriter and wrote a whole bunch of scripts and made a very little money and not a lot of movies. And discovered that in the world of porn, you could actually make movies using just, you know, write a script and then it went away someplace. No, you could work it all the way from the beginning to the end. I got interested in directing and so on.
Like I said, your career has been all over the place and you've been everywhere from London to New York to San Francisco. Tell me what you did with Walt Disney.
Ha! That's pretty funny. It wasn't directly for them. In fact, I didn't even know I was working for them. I was working for a development company, all part of the complexities of how they make movies and why they make so few of them, actually.
Mm-hmm.
There was a development company that liked one of my spec scripts and optioned it, asked me to do a rewrite on it, which I did. They were very happy with the rewrite. In fact, they were too happy with it. It turned out better than they expected. And unbeknownst to me, they had a pass-through deal with Disney to develop any property that of theirs that Disney wanted to do.
Oh.
So, to the surprise of all, they grabbed this script and took it away. And, of course, the first thing they do is fire the writer who wrote it and
obviously
hire their own.
Yeah, that's the first step.
You know, they paid me for a little bit of consulting. And then they basically, as they do with those kinds of things, put it in a drawer somewhere, and that was about the end of that.
Okay. I just love the idea that a fellow pervert had worked in any way, shape, or form for the mouse. I think that's greatly kinky.
Well, I'm not going to name names or point fingers, but I can tell you there's more than one.
Yeah, I'm sure.
We're everywhere. Ernest and I are just lucky in that we are able to live out lives without it damaging us on a day-to-day level.
Yeah.
May mess up our resumes for trying to get a regular job, but we're very fortunate we don't have any families to embarrass, and we have no children to mortify.
Yeah.
So we're able to live an out life, which is one of the pleasures that we do get to indulge.
One of the reasons I think we were attracted to this particular field of endeavor was because we could really explore the subjects that interested us, and we did not have to pretend to be people other than who we are.
Yes, yeah. That's a huge benefit.
And as a step-parent, I will say, it's fun to mortify the children.
Aha, you might have spoken like a true parent.
Oh, goodness.
You're a sick man beast.
Yeah, well, we know that. When you first came to L.A. as a screenwriter, I think there was something in the foreword to Master of O. You wrote a comedy about Betty Page.
Yeah, I did. That wasn't before I came here. That was after I was here.
Okay.
I had written an article about her for Rolling Stone in 1989, which put me a little ahead of the curve because I had an interest, of course, in fetishism and knew who she was, and she was just starting to become a cult figure again.
Yeah.
So I talked to a lot of people who knew her and went to New York, spent some time there, wrote an article about it, and it gave me the idea to write a script about her encounter with the Kefauver Commission when the last time that some politicians decided that, you know, pinup pictures were a menace to society.
Well, you know, we're here in Nashville, Tennessee, and Betty is one of our native daughters, so.
Yes, she is.
Yeah.
And actually, I did finally get to meet her. I got to interview her,
wow.
And I spent some time with her. She's really quite an amazing person.
Well, she always just had such a wonderful enjoyment on her face. You know, she just seemed to really light up when she did her work, and that tells you a lot about a person.
She likes being naked.
Yeah.
And in her time and place, it was a rare thing for a woman to admit. She did express regret that she ever took pictures that showed her pubic hair, but her naughty nude, she was very happy without her clothing on outdoors in nature.
Or as she put, you know, she became quite religious in her later years, and as she said, well, we were made that way in the Garden of Eden, and that's how we were intended to be.
Sounds like she had a good way of looking at it. So,
yeah.
You've done about 500 titles, I guess, as either a writer, director, or producer.
That is correct.
That's an awful lot of work. And I know you collaborate with Nina on the educational series. You co-authored.
Yes, we did. We've made 40 of them. We've sold over a million of them. So we like to think there's a million and some people out there that we've helped enlighten in one way or another.
Exactly. You have. You've helped a lot of people either directly or indirectly have better sex. So that's something.
Well, my thing is I can't be with everyone myself. So I sent the movie.
Okay. I can identify with that. That's wonderful.
You can't do everybody, but I'm trying so hard.
Oh, goodness.
You know what? I need your help. I can't do them all myself. Help me where
okay,
you are.
I will. I will bravely take up that task.
Believe me, the beast is out here trying one person or many people at a time to work his way
good.
Through.
Oh, good.
So.
Oh, good. Well, much success to him.
It's a dirty job, but somebody has to do it.
Exactly.
And it's nice to know that you're out there doing it for us. So.
I'm sure he's thinking about you when he does.
I hope not.
No, me thinking about me, sir.
Oh, thinking about you.
Yes. Well, you know,
he is
kind of a creepy guy sometimes, so
well,
you never know.
Nina, I was very pleased. Several years ago, I was in our local branch library and leafing through the shelves, and I ran across one of your books in our mainstream very conservative neighborhood library, and that was most satisfying to know.
Oh, goodness.
That,
was it a book of essays that I had contributed to?
No, it was one of your how-to books.
Wow.
Oh, there's only one of those. That would have to be Nina Hartley's Guide to Total Sex from Avery Penguin.
Yeah.
Yes.
Wow, that's awesome. The library, that really is heartening that someplace like Nashville would have that in the library. That's
and the buckle
great.
Of the Bible, Bill.
And this library was flanked on each side by a church.
Well, isn't every
well,
library
what?
Here?
Yep. Well, you know, whether you believe it was God-given or nature-made, we are able to feel really, really good for a reason. And then you add some kink sex to that, which Ernest taught me how to do, then it gets even more fun.
Oh, boy. Kate, I am hijacking you.
Yes, you are a little bit, but I understand. You're the master, so you can do that. Your background, Nina, you started out as a registered nurse.
I started out as a nursing student. Overlapped my schooling with my early days as both a dancer and then a weekend pornographer.
Mm-hmm.
I got my degree in 1985, passed my test, got my license, and promptly went into entertainment full-time, and this year marks, this year marks both Ernest and my 30th anniversary in adult entertainment.
Wow. Congratulations.
Which means together we have 60 years experience in a field that's only 30 years old, which is pretty amazing.
But you were there for the beginning of it.
Yep.
We were. Actually, sir, it's been legal for 42 years.
Oh, all right.
Oh, but
there you have it.
But 60 years experience in a business only 40 years legal is pretty good.
Yep. That's an amazing statement right there.
I did find out one thing that I wasn't aware of when I was looking into your past, that you played a part in a film called Who's Nailin' Palin?
Yeah.
You're playing Hillary Rodham Clinton in a film.
Yeah.
I have to go check that. I got to go find that because that would work for me on so many levels. So.
Oh, wonderful. The part is small. The star, of course, is Lisa Ann, who bore, except for her bust, bore a remarkable resemblance to Ms. Palin. And she was my agent at the time. I saw Sarah Palin on TV, and I turned off the TV, and I called Lisa Ann and said, "You have got to do a movie as this person. You are just a spitting image of her." And she did, and it kicked her career off. So she sold her agency and has been full-time back in entertainment ever since.
Wow. I also really enjoyed your role in Boogie Nights, and I wanted to ask you how you felt about its portrayal of the adult entertainment industry.
Well, the most important thing when watching a Hollywood version of any industry in which you are a part is to recognize, oh, that's the Hollywood version of that.
Mm-hmm.
As a filmmaker, the story left me a little bit lukewarm, I'm not mm-hmm. going to lie. The experience was awesome. It's my only time on a professional, proper movie set, and I know it probably will be my only time because it was a bit of stunt casting because he'd been a fan mm-hmm. since an early age. But he got a few of the details right, but he got the essence, I think, not quite so right. But again, it's a story out of his head against the backdrop of my business. And
yeah.
So I'm sure spies look at James Bond movies and just cringe.
You know, if you've ever been in any occupation of any sort and then seen it portrayed in a movie or on television, it's, you find yourself yelling at the screen. No,
yeah.
No, it's not like that, but you know, it's fiction.
Right.
That they have the right to do that.
Yeah. And unfortunately, though, when they send something out like that, so many people take it as gospel, and that's the problem we face with things like 50 Shades of Grey, is that people...
Yeah.
Yeah, that is a problem there, because that is, you know, that's not only uninformed, ignorant, and inaccurate, it really is, it's somewhat toxic. It traffics in some stereotypes that those of us who are active in the BDSM community have spent many years trying to dispel.
Exactly.
So
I will go beyond toxic to dangerous. I think we're...
I don't know if it's... You know, the idea of labeling books dangerous is always a dangerous idea.
Well, I'm not...
But I will say this. I think there are dangerous ideas, and
right.
books are a sort of a vector for them. There's right. some ideas that come that you can get in a book and then do something dangerous with, and of course that's the risk you take of having freedom of expression. For instance, as much as I dislike those books, I would not want them to not be published because somebody might get the wrong ideas out of them and do something they shouldn't.
I firmly support the First Amendment.
On adults acting like adults.
Oh, yes.
This is America.
Oh,
you
yes.
have to be careful about that, sir.
Yes.
Well, you can't count on it entirely.
But so many adults just forget the fact that they should act like adults. So.
Yes.
Yes, they should. I don't want to get into a lengthy critique of books that, frankly, don't merit a lengthy critique,
mm-hmm.
other than to say that where I think they're particularly off base is in the area of consent. The author seemed not clear on what consent really means, and the characters seem not clear on what consent really means. And
yeah.
That's one thing when it comes to BDSM that you need to be really clear about.
Really, really,
really clear.
Clear
about.
Well, you know, one of the things that I was reading, some of the reviews on Master of O, which
mm-hmm.
one of the ones that I really liked said that comparing your book, Master of O, to 50 Shades was like comparing Moby Dick to Jaws.
Aww.
And
of course, I like both Moby Dick and Jaws, so I don't know what to say about that. But yeah, I saw that, and I thought it was great and somewhat to the point. I mean, if you want to, I did not write the book with the purpose of it being instructional in any way, but
mm-hmm.
I think it if you want some sense of what that life and its pleasures and perils are like, in the same way you would if you wanted to know about whaling, you'd go to Moby Dick.
Right.
And if you were interested in marine biology, you probably wouldn't go to Jaws. It's one of those kinds of things where, you know, the intentions of the authors were pretty different. One person really wanted to sort of show you a world they knew, and the other person wanted to sell you a world they'd heard about.
Well, you know, that leads me to another thing. That there was a quote from you in the foreword to Master of O, talking about 50 Shades, and even talking about Story of O, that the author set the precedent for mainstream writers who take on the subject of BDSM to this day, with a disclaimer to the effect that none of their understanding is derived from their personal histories. They're telling us about people they know a bit, but whose company they don't care to be seen as keeping. And that really, yep, that really hit home with me, and it summed it up so well of what I dislike about so many books out there.
Well, you know, O is a different kind of situation. It's a much better written book because, frankly, the writer was a much better writer.
Oh, yeah.
And it avoids some of the pitfalls of later attempts, but it was still written by someone who was very much an outsider, mm-hmm, and not part of that world, and in fact had something of a grudge against it, because after all, it was originally written as a sort of an entertainment for her lover of the time, who was very interested in BDSM. She did not share that interest, but as she said in her, when she finally gave an interview and outed herself about having written it, she said that it was sort of done on a dare. She said, I can't do the things that you want me to do, but I can write about them. So
yeah,
she wrote him this book as a sort of a birthday present, and, you know, in longhand in a notebook. She never intended for it to be published, and he read it, and he's a big figure in the publishing world in France at the time, and he said, no, this is too good. We're not going to put this in a drawer and forget it. We're going to get it published. And she sort of went, but, and he was already out the door with a manuscript running off to Jean-Jacques Pauvert to get it published.
Yeah.
So, really, it was never intended to see the light of day, and I think it reveals some things about the author's own prejudices. I think one thing you could definitely say that's different between my take on this and hers is that there are people in my book you could like.
Yes.
In her book, it's hard to find anyone you'd like, and it's hard to understand why they do what they do, because she didn't understand the pleasure aspect,
right,
of BDSM play. She didn't emphasize that because she'd never experienced it. She didn't know what it was about, and couldn't see how these people could be motivated to do these things other than romantic obsession, which, you know, I understand that romantic obsession makes for good fiction, but it's not really the only reason people do BDSM. The main reason people do it is because they find that it's sexually exciting and stimulating and fun.
Yeah.
And as you say, sir, no one ever took a second beating out of love.
Oh, no. I mean, you know, there's no way in the world that O, especially the way her character is designed, would have endured all that nonsense if she didn't get something out of it. But in the introduction, they kind of tried to fudge that. No, she was really doing it to prove herself. I don't think anyone needs to prove themselves to that extent. In my book, I reimagined O as somebody who was already experienced in this area and had distinct tastes of her own, as submissive people do, and she meets a guy who is, has some great charms and some great flaws, but who's really terrific in the BDSM space, and mm-hmm, they have a very... they have a dynamic that works together very well. I think that's probably the best thing in terms of the structure of the book, is that you have two people who really are at the same level of understanding and who really meet there,
mm-hmm,
you know, and they really get out of it what is there to be found.
Well, yeah. You know, one of the things that I did enjoy, you just summed it up very well in looking at the circumstances of the original writer, of not being in this lifestyle, not understanding about the pleasure aspect, and really kind of being down on it, that came across when I read it the first time years ago, of wondering what was this woman doing this for, and it was as exciting as parts of it were, it was also disturbing, because when you're in the beginning trying to figure out, is this okay, or is this woman doing this just to please someone else, or does she want it?
Although I want to give some credit there to Pauline Rayage, sometimes known as Dominique Horry, but generally known as Anne Duclos, to people who actually knew her.
Mm-hmm.
She she actually got the consent thing straighter than Fifty Shades. The consent part of it is pretty explicit before they go to each new level of each new thing.
Yeah.
She's offered the chance to say, I don't want to do that. I'm out of here.
Yeah, but I still wasn't clear on her. I guess her motivation is more of what I'm thinking.
Well, she didn't really have motives, you know. There's a kind of chilling description of her previous love life in the book that would be very eye-opening for a lot of people who still think of Story of O as a romantic novel, because mm-hmm. O herself is not a romantic person. She had a past history as something of a heartbreaker who liked to get people to fall in love with her and then kick them to the curb, you know, and what she sort of liked about these guys was that they seemed to be immune to that kind of thing, which, you know, made them, of course, more attractive to her.
Mm-hmm.
But those were circumstances that I think were unique to those people. I think the circumstances around my characters are somewhat unique. One thing that's absolutely unique about it is that, and it's unique in most literature about BDSM, is that it's told from a dominant guy's point of view. That's a point of view we usually don't get. And there's some good literary reasons why that might be true. Obviously, from a submissive point of view, there's a lot of suspense and excitement over what's going to happen next and so on and so forth, and it's presumed that the dominant character already has that figured out. So what's going on in his head that's interesting? Well, the answer is quite a lot, and we haven't really been there before, so when I made it Master of O instead of Story of O, it is a story about both of them, but it really is seen through his eyes.
And I think that was a brilliant move. I mean, as you said, it's a viewpoint that we don't normally get. I can't think of course, I was also thinking that I haven't read a lot of erotica period written from the male point of view.
I think this is the first.
So kudos. So Kate,
you say you've been reading it. Can I ask, what's the last thing you remember reading?
Well, I sort of jumped from him using the pump on her private areas. And then because before we talked, I wanted to see how you ended it, because I know you had said that you didn't like the ending of the original Story of O, and I hated the original O's ending too.
Yep.
So I skipped to the end to Jackie and Ray's party.
Yeah.
Careful with the spoilers.
I don't want to spoil for anybody, but I skipped to that.
The perfection of the ending probably wouldn't make a lot of sense if you hadn't worked through the rest of the book, but it is a shocker, and it is, in my opinion, of a piece. If everyone behaves just as they've behaved all through the book, which is as themselves, and it's not what you expect.
I think it's a fabulous ending. I think it's almost the perfect ending. It sort of, the irony and celebrating that paradox of mm-hmm. what we do.
One thing I wanted to make clear is that there is no one brand of BDSM
Amen.
Relationship.
Amen.
What I like to tell people is if you've met one of us, you've met one of us. You know, it doesn't mean that necessarily, whatever you know from knowing one of us doesn't necessarily mean you know a whole lot about everybody else who's involved in the same kinds of things.
Exactly.
There are happy BDSM relationships. There are unhappy BDSM relationships. There are some that will last a lifetime, and there are some that will flame out at some early point. You don't know going in what it's going to be, but really the variety is as broad as the variety of human emotion.
Yes. I think that one of the most damaging things in the world in anything is having this perception of that people don't react individually, that there's one way to do it. That's true.
Right, exactly. Yeah. I mean, we got a lot of different characters doing a lot of different things under a lot of different circumstances, and we see that even though some of the things they do are similar, the way in which they do them and the emotion surrounding is very different.
Yeah.
So that was one of the stereotypes I sought to dispel, was that, you know, it all goes according to this one blueprint that we all follow. Everyone in the world who's into this meets every Tuesday night so that we can make sure we're all on the same page.
Exactly. Got that same boilerplate contract, because we all have contracts.
Well, wait a minute.
Sure, absolutely. You know, that part was one of many things that I found, you know, raucously, unintentionally funny in reading the book whose names must not be spoken.
Exactly.
There was a lot of legal paperwork involved, but of course, none of that legal paperwork would have been legal, which is part of the absurdity of the situation, because you really cannot agree to do something that the law doesn't recognize as legitimate. So you can sign all the paper you want, but it won't apply to anything. Some people do have individual contracts, which are more like vows.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
I think that's a lovely, that can be a lovely romantic thing.
But you will still find submissives on FetLife in discussions and chat rooms insisting that because they signed a contract, they cannot leave.
Oh, please.
I take pride in the fact that I was literally run out of the largest master-slave group on FetLife for daring to say that I thought that was nonsense. You know,
yeah.
And I said, you know, in this country we have this thing called the 13th Amendment that forbids involuntary servitude.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, no matter what contract you sign, you can't make the Constitution go away. That is a right that you have as a human being, so there's not much that can be done. You can't surrender it. And there were all these people saying, but you don't understand, I really can't leave because it's in my reality, that's impossible.
Yeah.
Well, I suppose you're entitled to your own reality, but the one that most of us live in is, you know, governed by law and other things. And we understand that if on any given day someone who was in a master-slave relationship decided they wanted to leave and their dominant partner didn't want them to go and made something of a fuss about it, all they had would have to do is pick up the phone, call 911, and that would be the end of that.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yes, I
do want to. It takes the place of a religion for some people. They really believe they can't. They're incapable of doing this. Well,
yeah.
That turned into a long argument that went on for a long time in that group until finally.
That argument's always going on. It took me, I don't know how many years to figure out. I kept having the same arguments over and over and suddenly realized, why am I doing this to myself?
I was very glad to be out of there. One of the ground rules in that particular group says you are not allowed to tell slaves that they can leave. You know, wait a minute here. I mean, if they're of the age of consent, they probably already know they can leave. They just don't want to, which is fine if they'll simply say, psychologically speaking, I can't imagine that I would ever want to do this. I'll never argue with that.
But that would require...
I can't imagine my life without...
Yeah.
You know, being the slave to my master, well, that's certainly a legitimate position. But for them to say that they are not capable of making a different choice and acting on it is simply not true.
Well, I think so much of what we do is about basically a mind fuck. And some people have mind fucked themselves into problems with reality, I think.
Yeah, I think they build their own reality, which is okay up to a point, but there's something to me that really goes against my feelings about consent, which I see as an ongoing process. It's not like you say yes once, which is pretty much the plan with some of these people, and then from then on you don't have the right to say yes or no. I see consent as an ongoing expression of a mutual desire to pursue a certain thing. As soon as it's no longer mutual, the consent is no longer present and it's no longer valid.
Exactly.
And I just think if people lose sight of that, then what develops instead is an abusive and or codependent relationship in which they feel they can't leave for all kinds of reasons that have nothing to do with why they might want to stay.
Yeah. And it's,
you know,
not...
That's the question I want to ask these people that can't leave. Well, okay, let's pretend for a minute you could leave. Would you?
Yeah.
And I suspect that if half of them answered that question honestly, they'd say, yeah, well, probably. So it's important to them to believe that they can't leave, because otherwise they would.
Well, that's, you know, one of the things I thank you for. Together and apart, you've both been instrumental in rescuing BDSM porn from people who really didn't have a clue about how it worked.
Well, it's a modest mission, but we've pursued it vigorously.
But one of the things that I did read was that you two met on a set for a movie, for a video, and there was a rape scene. And Nina was...
It was written as a rape scene, and I was high on my feminist high horse, and I just did not do things like that. That was very, you know, only four years into my career, and I just really was not comfortable with the scene. I was definitely not going to do it. And then Ernest, understanding power dynamic and power exchange in a way that I just had not got my mind around yet, said, took the same scene and then said to
me, take charge of it.
You know, okay, if you were having sex for your life, what would you do? Oh, okay.
So she became the aggressor in the scene, and it was quite amusing. I mean, we were saddled with a bad script that had been written by the producer's buddy, which is always a problem on any kind of feature thing. There's always someone or something you're stuck with because somebody's friend got involved. So it was really a pretty bad script, and that scene couldn't have been written more inappropriately for the person who was gassed in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I just I figured for one thing I have an objection to bad writing, so I was kind of determined to subvert it anyway.
Yeah, that's the ultimate
scene.
And when
Nina and I were talking about it, I said, well, let's just, you know, we'll do the same dialogue, but we'll completely change the slant of the scene, and the guy who wrote it won't be smart enough to tell what we did.
He won't know what hit him.
What about the co-performer in that? He was reading from the script, and was he a bit taken back by the change in attitude of his of Nina?
He's a very sweet guy. It was Peter North, who was, you know, a big star at that point, and really a very nice person. And I think he was completely, first he was confused by the way the scene was originally written, and then he was even more confused by the way it was played. But you know what? He's a pro, and he stepped up, and it turned into a really fun scene, except for the fact that it was set in, you know, in the Salem witch trials era, and he had to wear a powdered wig, which kept sort of gradually moving over his face until
goodness.
He began to look like Cousin It.
It was so funny.
It was really
he's so hair sensitive, he really did not know what to make of it.
Yeah, he's one of those guys that, you know, doesn't like having it. He wears his hair in a very particular way, doesn't like having it messed up. He always tells new players he's working with, hey, don't mess with my hair.
Oh, dear.
So we messed with his hair to start out with. So he was already off his markers when the scene started.
The poor
and
guy.
Then, course, you know, Nina played it completely the opposite of the way it was written. And as I said, professional that he is, he stepped up.
Yes, he did.
Oh, that's funny. I'm going to have to go look for that and watch that wig slipping.
It's called Stairway to Paradise. I do not know if they've released it onto DVD, but they might if they had any kind of classics program at VCA from 1989. Yeah.
Beast is writing that down as we speak.
1989.
Yeah.
I was the roommate of a friend of Nina's who was directing this picture.
Mm-hmm.
And I was working as the assistant director for this person, and that's how we all got to know each other.
And you two, Nina, you were with someone else when you met, and I read something about...
Yes, I was. I am someone who, before she understood that she was naturally non-monogamous and was not a character flaw, was a cheating kind of person.
No,
and
I wasn't even going
to
go there.
My ex-husband, I'm not happy. We have to renegotiate our agreement. We have to open the relationship up. I said what it was. I lived in a three-way marriage, and they had been supportive of me getting into adult, and they had been supportive of me being a stripper. And they're supportive of the swinging, but as soon as I became interested in BDSM, they got all kinds of Midwestern judgmental on me about those people and what it meant to want sex that way. And
so we responded by having an affair.
You know, I responded by, and so when I met Ernest and was, you know, coming home with this information, they just were very, very stonewalled, very judgmental, you know, just unbelievable. Where they'd been previously fairly open-minded. And so instead of saying, well, F you, I'm leaving, I started to have a clandestine affair and realizing this is... And what was really nice to know when all things were said and done, what I was so excited to find out was that the excitement was not coming from it being clandestine. The excitement was coming from the power exchange and realizing that this was something that I was natively interested in. And, you know, some women know they want to have a dominant partner, and they search for him, and they dream of him. But I fell in love with the man, not the role.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was thrilled to know that I could discover a new way to have sex that was unlike anything I'd ever experienced before and has been consistently, nothing else has been consistently as hot as as power exchange with a romantic partner with mutual affection. It's pretty awesome.
Yeah, I was not going to go into the whole judgmental cheating thing because I've been there. I stood in those shoes, and it's a particular terrible thing, but sometimes you feel like you're in a place where that's your only option to get what you need.
I did feel that way. I mean, you know, if I was monogamous, I would realize, oh, my feelings for this person mean that my old relationship is dead. Now, the old relationship was dead. I just did not recognize it at the time. It had been dead. It was dead on arrival, and mm-hmm. I just didn't understand enough about relationships to recognize.
I offered to loan her a shovel, but she wasn't ready for that.
I know.
But I'll tell you what. We
met it for lost time.
we did have that. We had that wonderful sort of torrid thing for about a year and a half.
Yeah. A year and a half.
It's not my thing either. As a general rule, I won't be involved with somebody who is clandestinely involved with anybody else. But in this particular case, I had a feeling things were going to develop along a different line, and it took a while, but that's true. She went back to them, and then 8 years later...
8 years, Kate.
Wow.
8 years.
Well, and I will tell you that I did not live a celibate monkish life during those 8 years. I went on with my life, and I had lots of fun, and, had
lots
of great adventures. But at the end of each one of those adventures, and sooner or later they all seemed to hit the wall, I would say to my friends, it's too bad that thing with Nina didn't work out, because that made a lot of sense, and they'd all go, oh, God, when's he going to get over it?
Oh, dear.
And the answer was never.
Yeah.
So when she called me after she had left and said something along the lines of, I've left my husband, are you free for lunch?
Pretty much, that blunt, very blunt.
And I just said, yes, and for the rest of my life, I'm clearing my entire social calendar right now.
That is so fucking romantic.
I just love that.
And in fact, we've been together since. We've really been officially together since the year 2000, and we've been legally married for 11 years.
Wow.
And, it's still new. It's still fresh and wonderful, and we're still really happy to be together.
Yes. And I still like banging him, and every other man, it's been, okay, that's enough. Three times is good.
Well,
and it's been hundreds of times, and it's still like, there's more there. I want more.
One great thing about BDSM is it does greatly expand the range of things that you can do.
Oh, yeah.
There are lots of things you can do to keep it fresh, mm-hmm. and that's one of the things that's fun about it, is it's always a little bit unexpected. We have certain things that we have favorites that we play, and then every now and then we vary it a little bit, because there's nowadays, of course, plenty of great new gear that's specialized for certain things, and there are all kinds of things people have explored, so you can learn about them, you can get instruction in them, learn how to do them well, and it's a great adult playground. We have a nice dedicated play space studio in the place where we live, with just about every kind of gizmo and gadget and thing that you might want for any purpose. And we usually find some purpose for some of them every time.
Well, that's one of the things I found so fascinating in Master of O. You talk a lot about the different... Well, there's so much rich detail about the sensuality of a very aesthetically driven life.
Yes.
Thank you for recognizing that.
Yes, thank you. Yes, it is. It's not in any way inauthentic, but there is an element of style and performance in it.
Well, yeah,
that actually adds to that doesn't distract you from the personal connect, from the intimate connection. It actually enhances it. It shows that you put some art and some thought and some creativity into what you're doing,
mm-hmm.
And that there's an aesthetic around it that really adds to it. One of the things I like about BDSM when it's done right is that it's rather beautiful in its way.
Yes.
Well, there's a certain dramatic theatricality in some scenes that. It feeds something, I think, that we want to perform. We want to make a spectacle. We want to create art within something else.
You can live your own romance novel in this world.
And you write it to suit. You can develop with the right person exactly the tone and tenet of your own you know, romantic, you know, epic saga. I mean, now, so Ernest and I have known each other 25 years. This is a love story, 25 years in the making.
Now, see, we've gotten a long way into the show here without doing the thing that we always have to do. You know what we have to do?
We have to talk about Master of O.
We have to say that if you want your own copy of Master of O, you have to go to masterofo.com.
Bum, bum, bum.
Which is where you can order it either as an ebook or as a nice big thick paperback that also works well as a paper as a paperweight or a doorstop.
Now, it's a beautiful cover on that too. That it's a beautiful satin black background with the O made out of the collar.
Yes,
it's beautiful.
Thank you. I will pass that on to the man who designed it. He'll be very pleased to hear it.
Well, I think it's like the book. It's very elegant and intriguing and mysterious.
Well, and there is. I will reveal this little tidbit of information. There is an illustrated version in the works. It won't be out for a while because it takes a while to do those. But the artwork is lovely, done by a guy who really does understand it very well. Pretty soon you'll be able to read it and see it in pictures.
Is that the art that you've been, there's something you've been posting on FetLife?
FetLife
and Twitter, yes.
Yes, I have seen those images.
Using that as a little bit of a bait to throw out there, but there are actually going to be about 45 illustrations
wow.
in the book, and I'm obviously not going to show a substantial percentage of those.
No, I want
people to buy the book.
Yes, you do want to buy the book. It's so good. It's a green night, Kate, that you're liking it, because I like to say it is a sex book that doesn't offend women, and it is a romance book that does not bore men.
And now we're going to take it to the graphic novel crew.
We love a graphic novel out of it. Right now, we're just having an illustrated version.
Yeah, exactly. It's going to be the same text, but each you know high moment will be depicted in a really excellent way.
Mm-hmm.
But I urge people not to wait for that to come out. It's going to be a little while. I think they should buy the book and read it. In fact, the guy who edited it for the publishing house said, I'm glad there's going to be some delay because I want people to get a chance to experience the reading of it on first on their own.
Mm-hmm.
So we went with this plan.
Yeah, it's a beautiful story. Another one of the reviewers talked about it. It's like Gatsby meets Kink Lit. That's kind of sums up the opulence and the... It's very much set in... a life plane that most of us aren't going to get to, but we can enjoy it vicariously through the book.
Well, you know, it's interesting. There were class politics evident in the original story of O. They're kind of subtly played, but they were definitely there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's certainly true in the modern world as well. These characters lead kind of luxurious sort of Hollywood lives, but they're really, in some sense, just, you know, they're creative people, they're artists, they're successful, but they're not really part of the privileged class. They sort of work for that class and are very well treated by it as a result. But overall, one of the themes that runs through it is fetishism and how objects become sexual. And, of course, that goes beyond directly sexual objects to objects, luxurious, fabulous, sensual objects of their own, which, of course, is what consumer culture is built on.
Yeah.
So fetishism and consumer culture have a lot of overlap, and one of my little sly attempts at relevance to modern contemporary concerns in this book was to be out front about that and say, yes, people do fetishize objects, and they really do get a turn-on from having them. So that is there. And also, if you're going to have a fantasy that you're constructing, completely in your head, and you don't have to go out and buy all the props and create all the sets and so
you
on,
you might as well go for it.
You have an unlimited budget.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly.
Well, it's like, walking into Stephen's closet for the first time. I think I had a materialistic quiver in my private parts, thinking about
that
having,
was the point.
Yes, exactly. Having that much space and all the lovely things in it.
Yeah.
Yes, it's very much. It's very much about sorting out the love of people from the love of things, which turns out to be the main conflict, inner conflict in the lives of the people there. And indeed, without giving anything away, it's surprising who manages to handle that challenge mm-hmm. best. You know, it's not who you'd expect.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to submit. No, I'm not going to say any more about that. You'll have to read it if you want to know what I mean.
Well, I do intend to get back, especially this weekend. I've got a long weekend. I will be able to curl up and fill in the bridge between what I've read and what I jumped ahead. So.
Fabulous.
And let me plug again.
The rest of it.
Masterofo.com.
Masterofo.com.
Perfect.
I used to do radio, so I just.
Oh, goodness.
By the way, while I've got my voice stuck in the middle of this thing, I saw you guys at Thunder in the Mountain in 2000, I think, three.
Wow.
And the two of you were amazing then, and I'd been a fan ever since.
Well, thank you very much. That was a great time. We'd love to get back there again. You know, Denver's my hometown.
Yeah.
Ah, yeah.
And I'm, you know, I still love and miss it. I think it's a great place. I love growing up there. It was perfect for growing up. And then at some point or other, I had to get out in the world. And I always tell myself, well, one of these days when all my adventure, all of our adventures are done, we'll move back to Denver and live a nice, peaceful, retired life. But it doesn't look like it's going to happen soon.
Somehow I can't see y'all doing that, yeah. Just don't see you doing that. But as a couple, you're not just into BDSM, you're also poly?
Well, we're not. I wouldn't describe us as poly. We're simply, you know, we are non-monogamous.
Okay, yeah, I see that there's a difference there.
There is a difference in that we...
Our orientations are slightly different, but they overlap really well.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Ernest is 100% leather, and I'm 40% leather, 40 poly, 20 vanilla. But even in my non... Even when I'm with people who are not my dominant partner, because Ernest is the only one of those that I have,
mm-hmm.
there's still power exchange elements are certainly... masochistic, sadistic elements. I like to play very physically with other people, but I don't have any other romances going on.
Mm-hmm. No.
I have close friends that are a little genderqueer, a little intersexed. You know, Ernest is, as they say, all men.
Mm-hmm.
But romantically speaking, we are monogamous, yes.
Okay.
We have no other emotional involvement with any seriousness with anyone else, but we are definitely open for having a good time with other people whose idea of a good time is compatible with ours. So, and it, you know, it's a funny thing. Neither one of us is just a curious absence in our personality. We're just not the jealous type.
Well, I always wanted to be not the jealous type, and I learned how to. You have never been the jealous type, and you're just that guy. I always was that person underneath, but I had to get over some cultural and experiential bull hockey to finally be able to live the non-jealous, non-possessive life that I always wanted. It's hard to find a heterosexual man who will go with that.
Yeah, I don't know what it is, but I just never could understand why anyone would take an interest in what people did with their anatomy, with their own anatomy, when you weren't using it. I mean, it shouldn't go to waste. They have a use for it, and they should go out and use it in a way that they like. It's really... not a concern for me. It never has been. I figure I can't picture it happening, but if Nina actually met somebody that she'd be happier with, what would I want her to stay and be unhappy with me?
Well, society says that that's the way it is.
Yeah.
I've never rarely met a man who is so confident in his domination, in his role, who is also equally, who is not also possessive and a little worried.
Why worry? I've been doing this for 30 years.
And they keep coming back.
You know, let me tell you, one thing you discover when you out yourself as a dominant person with some capabilities is that there seem to be a lot more submissive people in the world than dominant people in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty easy to have your dance card fill up, and if it's known that this is a thing that you have some knack for, so it's never been a problem. Some of the people have occasionally been problems, but that problem is usually pretty brief because I'm one of those guys who doesn't like drama very much, and you know when it starts to happen, you know that little warning light goes off in my head, and I say, I think we've gone through the good part of this, and now we would have the not good part, so we'll skip that.
You can't see this, but my master and co-host over here, Beast, is grinning from ear to ear and nodding enthusiastically at everything you're saying, because we have had our own, Nina, I was going to say, if you can write down the secret to learning to be not jealous and not having those insecurities, if you could share that with the world, I would buy that book. Because I need it.
I mean, that's really good. Because it was first the most important thing to remember is I wanted the fantasy I had in my life of having multiple partners, nobody being hurt, nobody being upset, nobody having to lie about it, and just being okay. That was there before I ever had a partner. And so imagine my surprise when this lovely world I had in my head of everything being fine and easy and loving and fun hit. Oh, potholes is too low of a word. hit. It was like being sucked into the jet.
Went into the ditch.
Went into the ditch. And it's like, well, that's odd, because in my mind, it's this way. In my reality, it's this way. And I realized it wasn't just the partners that I had picked. It was also my own layering of acculturation over my true desire. So working through that, it was very personal. It was all personal work about my own insecurities and pulling up my big girl panties, and then holding out for a partner who really was that way as well.
Okay.
And not my first partner said he was, but he wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
And so that got really messy.
We have all
so
been
if
there.
You have the desire to get over your jealousy, and your partner is not, my role in my brain is, if my partner is not doing something in order to be a douche, then,
not to put too fine a point on it.
No, if he's not doing something deliberately, being a jerk, then that's a mirror to my own insecurities. Thank you very much for making me aware. I now should go work on them in therapy, journaling, meditation, whatever I do to get to the bottom of my stuff, and then we can move forward. And I was mostly over it, but the first couple years I still had bad habits left over from my previous relationship, and Ernest was very patient and letting me know that I did not have to lie to him. I did not have to pretend something wasn't the way that it was. And he preferred the truth. And so now we get to live there all the time. So having one partner already firmly in the I really am not a jealous person camp, it helped made it easier for me to join him there, because I wanted to live there anyway.
Mm.
Now, if I was monogamous, it would be a whole different, I would have had a whole different trajectory, but I did have non-monogamous fantasies in my head. I still have non-monogamous fantasies in my head, and yet I don't want to be alone in the world. Mating is very normal human activity, finding a partner to do the... And people have often said, well, Nina, if you're not going to be monogamous, why be married? And,
two
you know,
separate issues.
Yeah, yeah.
In my view, they're two separate issues. So Ernest is the through relationship, sickness and health, hot sex and Monday mornings and dead parents and life, intimacy, the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. And business of day-to-day living, you know, it's good to have a life partner, but your life partner doesn't necessarily have to be the only sexual partner you can have.
Mm-hmm.
We have them together. We have them separately. It's funny, we have some tastes that overlap and some that don't.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there are times when we want it to be a threesome, and then there are other times when we want it to be a couple of twosomes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, exactly. And the if you can tell if you're this kind of person, the more people I sleep with, the more I love my husband.
Thank you.
That's a beautiful sentiment.
Because anybody can be, humans being humans, and lust being what it is, and attraction and chemistry, anybody I have found can be fun once or once in a while. But day in, day out, sickness and health, et cetera, that's a special person, and you don't let that person go.
I'll try to keep that in mind.
It's for a lot of people, it's a difficult issue to resolve. I guess. Some little genetic thing happened with me, and they left that out at the factory.
They did.
It was like, gee, I think we forgot to put something in there, and I can't remember what it is, but he's got to ship out.
Right.
So there you go.
You and the Beast were in the same line, because he didn't get that part either.
Well, there's another person in this room that's in the same line also.
Really?
Yeah.
And I wasn't born with it, per se, but I did have experiences in my childhood that left me insecure in certain ways that manifested as jealousy. And actually, in the two instances with Ernest where I've had anything that other people would label jealousy.
Mm-hmm.
What came up in a couple of days was I wasn't jealous because I want my partner to have everything they want. I really believe that that's what I want. But it was grief.
Hmm.
And the grief for me meant the grief is just recognizing that being an adult is bittersweet. And as much as I would like to please my master in all of these ways, some areas I just can't. I just can't. Not for lack of trying, not for lack of desire, not for lack of willingness. I don't have that thing.
Exactly.
Yeah, some people, you know, some people are obviously more heavily wired for this kind of behavior than others. And Nina is quite strongly wired for it. But in my particular case, I knew that I was a BDSM person in the dominant role before I knew what sex was.
Mm-hmm.
Or BDSM.
Or BDSM was. I mean, it was just the way I was born that way.
Mm-hmm.
In that sense, for some people, I think it's orientational at the level of being gay. You know, it's just sex without it. Why?
Yeah.
And then for a lot of other people, who I guess would be the equivalent of bisexual people, it's like, I can enjoy this when I'm doing this, but I can enjoy something else when I'm doing something else, which is more the way Nina is.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one reason why we both had to make some accommodations. I occasionally like to play with somebody who likes nothing else but
right.
the kind of thing I like, and she likes to be able to play with people who are different from that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in order for us to make each other happy, which is the main goal here, to help each other stay happy, we have to make those accommodations, and I don't find it difficult, and I don't think at this point either one of us finds it difficult. It's
oh, goodness, no.
Now.
No, once I realize where my issues were coming from, it wasn't that I didn't want him to have it. It was like, I wish I could be the one to give it to him.
Yes, exactly. I'm with
you
there.
Even though I give him so many other things,
mm-hmm.
it's this one thing I can't give him, i.e. a certain kind of energy, a certain kind. For example, he's heterosexual, I'm bisexual.
There
so when
go.
He gets with a heterosexual woman, it's a whole different kind of energy between them,
mm-hmm.
being with a bisexual female.
And in the same way, I recognize that there's a lot of things in this world that I can be, but a woman isn't one of them.
Hardly, sir.
So, therefore,
and then we wouldn't be together if you were a woman.
Exactly. So therefore, in those times when she wants a female partner, well, I guess I don't qualify for that, and I wouldn't want her to be without it.
I thank you both for being so open and honest and sharing your secrets of success, because it sounds like you found a balance that really works for both of you, and that's wonderful.
Well, thank you. It's really a pleasure to talk about it. It's you know, you're obviously such a you're such an aware listener, and such a I know we're in friendly territory here,
okay.
So we feel free to open up. But it's most enjoyable, and you know, any time.
Well, thank you so much. And again, let's do the, you can find the book Master of O.
MasterofO.com.
Thank you so much.
Follow Master on Twitter at The Master of O. And you can follow me on Twitter at Nina Land.
You have been listening to episode 33 of The Kinky Cast. Today we featured Ernest Green and Nina Hartley. The Kinky Cast is a production of Rooster in the Round. On behalf of Woody, the Beast, and Kate, I'm Max. See you next week when we hear from the Capricorn Witch.